Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Victor Nevasky, who is publisher and editorial director of The Nation. For 16 years, he was editor of The Nation. He's the author of several books, including Kennedy Justice, Naming Names, which won the National Book Award, and most recently, A Matter of Opinion. He is the Delacourt Professor of Journalism at Columbia, and here is his new book. Welcome to Berkeley.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
Where were you born and raised?
I was born and raised in New York City on the West Side, on West 74th Street.
And looking back, how do you think your parents shaped your thinking about the world?
Well, that's a good question. They chose the schools for me, and they sent me to a place called the Rudolf Steiner School from kindergarten until I was 10 years old, and I was going to be the only boy in the class at that point, and I decided I ought to leave, and my sister, who was a few years ahead of me, was graduating. And they sent me there because my father, whose father had come over here from Russia, believed that public school broke the spirit. Mm-hmm. And he had had a bad experience in public school. He never was able to go to college because his father started a business and all his sons had to go to work for it. My mother was his secretary. But Rudolf Steiner School made a fetish of cultivating the spirit. What my father, I don't think, understood was Rudolf Steiner believed that the spirit survives when the body expires in a quite literal way. Mm-hmm. He was a Christian Scientist, and he believed in reincarnation, none of which they taught us at the school. Mm-hmm. But it was a great experience. They cultivated the creative arts, and I learned my math by following the teacher around the room in a snake dance, saying 2 is 1 times 2, 4 is 2 times 2, because Steiner believed you develop in 3 stages. Stage 1, you discover the world about you. Stage 2, you discover the body. And stage 3, you discover ideas. I left at about the time you were supposed to discover ideas, but when I got out at age 10, 11, I knew French, German, Latin, Greek, and calculus. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't the smartest kid in the class.
Mm-hmm. And was your family a radical family politically?
No, not at all. I mean, my mother was a homemaker and politically couldn't have cared less. My father was a liberal, and he subscribed to The Nation and The New Republic, mm-hmm. so I grew up with these magazines mm-hmm. in the house. But he was a businessman who had no love for trade unions, because in the garment trade, the union that his business had to deal with gave him a very hard time.
Mm-hmm. And then you went on to Swarthmore from New York City. That's where you did your undergraduate work?
Yes. I first went to the Little Red Schoolhouse in Elizabeth Irwin after I got out of Rudolf Steiner, and then I went to Swarthmore, which, it's a non-denominational school, but it was founded by Quakers, and it was... it had a great piece collection and this sort of Quakerly belief in nonviolent resistance pervaded the campus, but it was a highly intellectual place. So I felt I had a great experience because on the one hand at Rudolf Steiner they cultivated the spirit and the arts, at Little Red Schoolhouse in Elizabeth Irwin they cultivated the social conscience. It was a progressive school in the tradition of John Dewey, and at Swarthmore they cultivated the mind. Then I went into the army and they cultivated whatever they cultivated in the army.
Your sense of bureaucracy, I guess.
That was part of it, but part of it, as I talk about in the book, is you had to learn the military arts. Mm-hmm. So I learned how to use a bayonet.
Mm-hmm. On to Yale Law School then.
Yes.
And how I sense that Yale had an even more profound effect on you. Is that fair? Or?
Well, I had the GI Bill, and I edited a newspaper both at Swarthmore. I edited the Swarthmore Phoenix, and in the Army, I edited the 53rd mm-hmm. Inf News. Mm-hmm. And I always thought, part of me wanted to be a journalist, part of me was interested in politics and public affairs. And because I had the GI Bill, I thought I could wait 3 years to be a writer because I didn't have that much to say yet, if anything, and that I would educate myself. And then I went to law school rather than graduate school because the Yale Law School was seen from its catalog like a place where you could carry on your liberal arts education and get a law degree. And I believed I had an entrepreneurial bent and that a law degree would serve me better in life than a graduate degree in political theory or political science or something.
And any teachers at Yale that influenced you profoundly?
Yeah, a number. Well, first there was Fred Riddell, affectionately known as Fred the Red, who wrote in the Yale catalog that he taught a course on law and public opinion and said, beware, people who take this course frequently end up leaving the law for journalism. And there I was. And I ended up working for Fred as a legal research assistant. And he taught, the way he taught that course, really, it's the only writing course I ever took, and he would have you write about the law, but you weren't allowed to use legalisms. Hmm. So you would have to, instead of saying due process or equal protection, you'd have to explain what they meant in layman's terms. And this was extremely valuable. And another professor who was very influential was Tom Emerson, who is known as Tommy the Commie, and then Boris Bittker, who is known as Bori the Tory, who taught tax law. But I had great admiration for Tom Emerson, who was put together the first legal textbook on political and civil rights. And I did a little work for him, too. I did some research for a revised edition of his textbook. And he was a very radical character who wore three-piece suits, parted his hair down the middle, and could have been a direct descendant of Ralph Waldo Emerson, for all I know. He was very conservative in his self-presentation. And So I had some great teachers. Harold Laswell was there. They had an extraordinary faculty.
And I would guess that at Yale you got a really important sense of the guarantees in our Constitution of the very rights that you went on to implement as editor of the Nation. That is the importance of a free press. The importance of an open dialogue on policy issues.
Yes. Yes. Yale Law School is very interesting. There was a battle in the legal community that went on at that time between the so-called legal realists and the more traditional jurisprudes, as it were. And Fred Riddell saw it as a battle between Harvard and Yale. And the way he talked about it, you know, that at Harvard they thought the law was a brooding omnipresence in the sky, and at Yale they thought the law was what the judge had for breakfast, that, you know, you do what you think is right. And that, and there was this scholar, Jerome Frank, who had argued in the 30s that all judges ought to be psychoanalyzed because of law was related to, you know, lawyers and judges were human. The so-called, not being above the law and putting these judges in black robes was disguising the reality that you were making policy decisions, and at Yale they wanted you to face up to that fact.
Now, after your graduation from Yale with a degree from one of the, if not the best school in the country, you set out to start a magazine of satire called Monocle. How did that come about? What does that tell you about? What does that tell us about you?
I say in the book that people might ask, why did it? A serious young man with a brilliant legal career ahead of him choose to go into this frivolous occupation. And the first thing is, maybe I wasn't that serious, and the second was, maybe I didn't have that brilliant a legal career ahead of me. But actually, we started Monocle while I was still a student at Yale, and then we graduated it with us. And this was at the tail end of the McCarthy period, and there was what I thought of as an irreverence boomlet going on, and we thought we were part of it. Mort Saul was out in San Francisco at the Hungry Eye nightclub with the Daily Paper commenting on what was happening. Nichols and May were improvising in Chicago, and we started Monocle magazine. There was another little magazine called The Realist, a journal of free thought, criticism, and satire that Paul Krasner had coming out of New York. And we thought we could challenge the pieties of the day through this, through satire, which didn't really exist in print in a serious way at that point.
Mm-hmm. And one thing you got out of this, I gather, is a real sense of the business of doing magazines.
Well, we did, because our editorial policy officially was the views of our contributors, no matter how conflicting and contradictory are the views of the editors. And we called ourselves a leisurely quarterly because we only came out twice a year at first. But here's what I learned. When we put out our first issue in New Haven, I wrote on the masthead that this is second-class matter, and we got hauled down to the New Haven post office, and we were told we were fourth-class matter. And I just had copied we're second-class matter from the Harper's Magazine. But I quickly learned that in order to qualify as second-class matter, you have to meet all kinds of bureaucratic postal regulations and pay an application fee. And at Monocle, I learned that all of the premises of magazine publishing, which I had assumed was just between writers and editors, depended on business assumptions. One, the postal office, which is a bureaucratic assumption, but secondly, Monocle had an odd shape. We called ourselves as tall as Time and as wide as Reader's Digest, and we thought we could sell ads in both. This caused us problems with the printer, because printing presses are built to certain size specifications, and it meant we wasted paper. Mm-hmm. At Monocle, we came to believe that the ideal magazine, because we had this odd publication schedule, we should be like the UN Peace Force and come out whenever there's an emergency or come out when you have something to say. But because of Second Class, you have to come out regularly. Mm. We learned that when we went on newsstands that, our theory had been, if one issue is worth 50 cents and the next issue is worth $2, you charge 50 for one and $2 for the next. No, it confuses the newsstand dealer if you have different prices. So every premise in the business was dictated by a business requirement. And I, of course, got interested in the business side of the magazines because I had to go raise money for them while I was there.
Your experience at Monocle, and which focused on satire, raises a very interesting question, which I'd like you to comment on, which is the role of satire as a form of social and political criticism. We're in a period now where if you go to parties at Berkeley and you ask them, what is the best source of news? It's Jon Stewart and the Comedy Hour. In your career, at various points, without going into all of these in detail, there are moments where you're involved beyond Monocle, for example, in the Iron Mountain Report, which was essentially a satire of academic bureaucratic reports. So getting back to the question, say something or help us understand what satire is and how it relates to kind of serious political criticism.
The line between humor and satire is elusive. Satire is meaner. At one point I used to say, because this is in the 1960s, it's the difference between attacking Ike, which is humor, and we published in Monocle the Gettysburg Address in Eisenhowerese, which began, I haven't checked these figures yet, but 87 years ago I think it was, and attacking Jack, which required satire, which meant a sharper scalpel. And we did a parody of J.F. Salinger, of Salinger in the style of Salinger, about called A Perfect Day for Honey Fits, about Jack and Jackie meeting meeting in college. And Carrie McWilliams, the editor of The Nation, said years later something that is a good answer to your question, although he wasn't talking about satire, but it spoke to me out of my experience putting out Monocle. It only takes one pinprick to deflate a balloon. Mm-hmm. And that's what satire is all about. It is about questioning the official line and doing it with humor, but with depth and bite, and it's an opportunity to expose pomposity.
You're also a man who's written two very important books, and so in a sense you've been a journalist, a researcher, and I would actually like, without going into detail about both of these books, and in fact I will show them. One was called Kennedy Justice, which was an analysis of Robert Kennedy as Attorney General, and the other, Naming Names, which won the National Book Award and is about the Hollywood 10 and the whole period of bringing to before the House on American Activities Committee the people who were charged with being communists. As a writer, in looking at both of these books, what is the what is required in doing good research, getting at the facts of a story that really the national myth sort of keeps from our right. understanding.
Right. Well, in both cases, let's see. I felt that it's a combination of scholarly research and traditional reporting, which means going out and talking to people. Mm-hmm. And one of the peculiarities is that journalists didn't routinely go to spend a lot of time in the library doing scholarly mm-hmm. research. Mm-hmm. And scholars don't talk to people. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't occur
to them.
Except
to themselves, but that's...
Well, no, but I've been a number of university presses have asked me to read manuscripts about people who I, know about in the business. And when they're scholarly manuscripts, I read them, and they add to the literature, and they want me to recommend, should we publish? I say, yes, and do you have any suggestions? Mm-hmm. I said, yes. There are a lot of people who are still alive who know these women or men, and why don't you have the mm-hmm. writer go out and mm-hmm. talk to them? They were there. Mm-hmm. So, and if you're doing book writing of the sort that I did, which was after Kennedy had left the Justice Department, people will tell you things that they wouldn't say while he was there, so you get a whole different view of and perspective of the history. And in the case of Kennedy, he got killed in the middle of my research. He was, by Sirhan Sirhan. And then people I had interviewed the first time, where I would travel across the country and see his former press secretary, who would tell me nothing that I couldn't have learned from reading all the newspaper clippings, opened up because I knew I wasn't trying to write a book to cash in on his death, and there was a whole mm-hmm. Kennedy industry that built up, but I was doing a serious attempt to explore what it was like to be the maximum attorney general, which as the president's brother with his full confidence was, because he knew how to franchise the Kennedy charisma, and so then I got to go into the files of Burke Marshall, his civil rights, head of his civil rights division, and spent weeks in his attic going through all these memorandums. So it's a very exciting kind of research. In the case of naming names about the Hollywood blacklist, there are two things about it. One was, having had the experience of spending 5, 6, 7 years working on the Kennedy book, I decided I wanted to spend my next book years in a place that would be fun to be. And that was part of my interest, not my whole interest in Hollywood. But I grew up with kids whose parents had been victims of mm-hmm. the so-called McCarthy Purge, the Great Fear, whatever you want to call it. And I thought, well, Hollywood wouldn't be a bad place to have to go to from New York, just as interviewing Kennedys wouldn't be a bad thing to do before. And so that was kind of the subversive motive for wanting to write a book about, to understand what had been going on in that period. But also, as you suggested earlier, I was keenly interested in civil liberties and civil rights. I did get that interest heightened that when I was at the Yale Law School, one night, Joe Rao, Washington lawyer, was coming to talk about the 10 things wrong with the House Un-American Activities Committee, and he had been Arthur Miller's lawyer and got him off before the court. And Miller, at that point, was engaged to Marilyn Monroe, and the word seeped through the law school that Marilyn Monroe was going to show up for Rao's speech because Miller was going to introduce him. Never have so many Yale law students been interested in civil liberties. The place was crammed to the rafters. And I got a real education in civil liberties that night because the head of the New Haven Civil Liberties Committee was the head of something called the Committee for the Protection of the Foreign Born, which was on the Attorney General's list of civil liberties organization, and he was Arthur Miller's rabbi, and Joe Rao was going to disassociate himself from the American Committee for the Protection of the Foreign Born because they were sponsoring the evening, and so Miller said he didn't feel he wanted to choose between his rabbi and his lawyer, so he stayed home. I claim he stayed home in bed, as it were. But I got my education in civil liberties there, so that was carried over to my interest in the Hollywood blacklist.
In both of these books, in addition to the digging for the information and the really doing the research, whether it was in the Justice Department or whatever, I was struck by the extent to which buried within your work, and it seemed to be informing it, was really political theory. Looking at the Kennedy book, I mean, the references to Max Weber, for example, and on the other hand, in the Naming Names book, you really laid out a very interesting set of theoretical a theory, basically, to understand the different kinds of informers and so on.
Yes.
So what I'm getting at is I really am intrigued by the fact that it seems that your background and a kind of a love and regard for theory has also informed your work, as you were suggesting, as you wear this hat of a scholar.
Well, I'm glad you think so. I don't know that I was conscious of that at the time.
Yeah.
At Swarthmore, yeah, I studied political theory, and I at Yale too, to a degree at the law school. But I saw the excitement of the Kennedy Project, not just in terms of a guy who, when I started, might become president of the United States, but it seemed to me no one had written a book about the attorney generalship before of a serious study of it. There had been some gestures towards that, but it wasn't a good book, and there was no case study. And here you had a situation where Kennedy had a chance not only to be maximum attorney general, as I said, because of his relationship to his brother, but he came up against the maximum bureaucrat in the form of J. Edgar Hoover. And something I didn't fully understand when I took on the project or the assignment was the FBI represented technically about 40% of the Justice Department's resources in terms of its budget, in terms of its manpower, but it actually was 50% of the department's ability to do anything, because the Bureau did all the investigations for the Justice Department. You couldn't do it without Hoover's and the head of the FBI, the maximum bureaucrat, was like the landlord. He's there in perpetuity. Attorneys general come and go. So how do you get when the immovable object meets the irresistible force? What happens? And so that was as much my interest as how Kennedy went about his business at a time of great civil rights trauma, where you had the uprisings in the South and all the other things, and the wind down of the Cold War. That was part of my interest, yeah.
Does the fact that you were a writer, journalist, make you, or did it make you a better editor when you became editor of The Nation?
It made me sensitive to the plight of the freelance writer, and I encouraged my colleagues at The Nation to keep freelancing for other publications so that they would get back to writers in a timely fashion, that they would not brutally kill pieces that didn't work out, that they would work to make pieces work if they had been given as honest assignments. When I was at the Times, it said on your, if an article was rejected, it said kill fee, which is the internal jargon for kill fee, F-E-E. And I said, why don't we change it to guarantee?
Yeah,
I said, it sounds better, Connor, because you guarantee your writer a third of the eventual fee if it doesn't work out. But sure, it, in addition to making one more sensitive to the plight of the writer, you know what's involved in putting together a story. You can give him or her guidance and suggestions as to how to go about researching. And I began by arming writers with books and articles to read, just because that hadn't been part of most journalists' training. And it's just something that I found natural, so I would do that. But they're very different skills, and we're meeting at a time when Roberts is up as a Supreme Court nominee, and he's saying, don't pay attention only to what I wrote when I was working in the executive branch, because I'm going to have a different role when I'm on the judiciary. The same thing is true about writers and editors. I remember writing an article about Ramsey Clark for the Saturday Evening Post when I was researching Kennedy Justice, and I used to freelance, and I take assignments related to the book, and I had an assignment to write an article that was 3,500 words, and they only had room to print an article that was 2,500 words, and I went through this grisly experience where the editor said, okay, we sat down to cut, and the first 500 words he took out of it, he said, I think this improves the piece. It makes it leaner and tighter and more pointed and all that. And then he would say things like, gee, that's a nice grade note. cut, too bad to lose it, you know, or this is really going to wound your piece, and there'll be blood on the floor, mm-hmm. cut, you know. And so you, as the editor, you have to do this. As a writer, you fight to protect your message and your space, and you're not, first of all, conscious of all of the other requirements, and secondly, you know, you don't have the responsibility for achieving the balance that a good issue mm-hmm. of a magazine has with one profile, one overseas piece, one humor piece, one this, one that. And so, yeah, those are different skills.
Now, you were an editor at the New York Times
yes.
Magazine and the editor
yes.
of The Nation. Now, those are two different publications,
different.
One at the heart of the center of the establishment,
right.
The other out on the left and a key voice of right. alternative opinion. Compare those two positions.
Well, the first major difference was at the New York Times, I sat in a huge room, like a classic newsroom, and one row in front of where my immediate boss, who was the articles editor, a fellow named Harvey Shapiro, sat with a half a secretary behind me. The other half, she worked for all the other editors in the magazine. And if I had an idea for an article or something, say, my tendency would be I'd turn around to Harvey and say, Harvey, what do you think about this? And then he'd have to discuss it with his boss, and then we'd have a committee meeting. It was very bureaucratic and all that. When I got to The Nation, my first day, I had what I thought was a good idea, and I was sitting at Carey McWilliams, who was the great editor of the magazine, his old, huge wooden desk. I had this idea, and my first impulse was to turn around, and right behind me was this dirty old chicken wire window, and I saw my reflection in it. And that said to me, okay, you're now in for a very different kind of ride, and the buck did stop there. And so that was a key difference. The second one, as you suggest, was that not the left so much, but the independence of the thing that we really were out there. And the third was, Carey McWilliams had once said to me written that the editor of The Nation is a captive of its tradition. And I didn't realize quite what mm-hmm. that meant, but what it turned out to mean in part was if you ran an article whose assumptions ran counter to the received wisdom of the left, without the mm-hmm. Nation had no party line, and it was not the dogmatic thing that people think it is, and I'll talk about that in a minute, but if it ran counter to the, like if you just assumed that integration was not a valuable thing, you would get slaughtered in the mail the next mm-hmm. issue. And so there are a whole bunch of expectations. It didn't mean you couldn't do it, but you had to be prepared for what mm-hmm. would come. And on the other hand, there when there are people who consider this magazine their lifeline, and that wasn't true about the New York Times Magazine. New York Times Magazine had a lot of readers, but as I travel around the country and go to small towns in North Carolina, on every college campus I would go to, there'd be one professor and some students, maybe more than one professor, who the local papers didn't cover international affairs and barely covered national affairs, and the national press they didn't trust, and or the television that they saw. And they lived every week to get this word, and they consider The Nation part of their identity. So that's a special kind of responsibility.
Now, at the Times, it must have been harder to break out of the conventional wisdom in comparison to what you just described in The Nation, which seems to be the conventional wisdom within the community that reads The Nation. One had to be careful
yes.
about doing that. But you could talk, though, a little about The Times. And
yeah.
was it easy to come up with a new idea back then about goings
well,
on in the world?
You know, they hired me after I'd been putting out Monocle, and I'd written a lot for The Times, so they had confidence that I could operate within their value system. But my first period there, I would suggest these ideas, and they would get assigned. But then when the articles came in, they wouldn't get published. And I got taken to lunch by my friend and editor one day, and he began to make a speech at me. And I had thought we were just going to lunch, and it turned out to be my evaluation lunch. And the speech was something like, Victor, you know, at the magazine, no matter how good a writer you are, how nice a guy you are, how smart you are, we ultimately judge you by how many pieces you got in the magazine. So I did a quick calculation. I said, well, by that calculation, I'm batting zero. So he smiled. smiled and said yes. And I started to say, gee, Harvey, why didn't you tell me? And I realized how stupid that was. Why else would I be there? Mm-hmm. So he told me they were going to extend my tryout period. I hadn't even known I was on a tryout up to that point. But under their deal with the union, you've got a certain 13 weeks, and then they could extend it. So they gave me a second 13 weeks. And I radically changed my ways. And what I changed was not the ideas I would submit, but I noticed a colleague of mine would always attach a clipping from the daily paper in and say,
the New York Times.
From the New York Times, yeah, to his idea. And their idea was that the magazine was supposed to be you cover in depth what the Daily covered only on the surface. So instead of submitting ideas, and I submitted a lot of ideas like I used to, I started writing them down on a yellow legal pad, and every time something appeared in the Daily paper about one of them, I would clip it on. And then, so they got the same idea, they got it weeks later than they would have gotten it, and it was a little, and the second thing I did was, if I had an idea that was at all offbeat, I would take a writer who had survived the system before, and just as I used to submit new writers, which I thought they would hire me to bring my Rolodex in there and get new people on their thing, if the idea was at all adventurous, I would take someone who had survived the system, because once you had survived two or three pieces, the presumption shifted from the presumption against you, it was hard to break into that place, to the presumption in favor of you. And all of a sudden, all of my ideas started sailing through. And then there came a time when we both were comfortable with each other. And then I could suggest some things that were upbeat. And one, I remember going to lunch with a colleague, Jerry Walker, and there was someone, a great writer named Merle Miller, who came to lunch, who wrote a best-selling book about Harry Truman. And we got to talking about a novel Jerry had written called Cruising, which dealt with a gay policeman, a homosexual policeman. And there had been an article in Harper's by Joseph Epstein that had upset Merrill. And out of the lunch came out that Merrill was gay, and he had never told anyone before, and he was very upset, and he wanted to answer this article by Epstein. I said, well, why don't you write an autobiographical piece for the magazine talking about your own attitude towards your sexuality and what's wrong? You know, use that as a way to critique. And Jerry said, well, they'll never buy that, you know, and I said, well, there's only one way we can find out, so we went and proposed it, and they were intrigued, and they knew Merle was a great writer, and they said, well, let him try it, but make clear to him in advance it's a long shot, because it's be very different for us. Well, he wrote something that was irresistible. They couldn't not publish it. They ended up getting 2,000 or more letters than they ever got for an article. He turned his article into a book, and that was a story with a happy non-ending.
Let me show your book again for our audience, A Matter of Opinion. Here it is. There are several very important themes that you look at in this book, and I want to pick up on some of those now. What is the role of a journal of opinion in our society? And here we're talking about magazines that are as diverse as National Review, Commentary, The New Republic, and The Nation.
Well, one of its roles, and it depends who's in power and all that, but is as a dissenting journal. And I think that's one of its most valuable roles. And in the case of The Nation, it's dissenting to the powers that be, corporate or political or cultural. A second is to put new issues on the national agenda. A third is to rally the troops in time of trouble. You want to know, let people know that they're not alone. Mm-hmm. And if they have ideas that are offbeat. And, you know, National Review, I think Buckley in the first issue, he said something like, our goal is to stand astride history and yell, stop, because everything was moving in a liberal direction. And they nourish, another role, function is to nourish writers and ideas and cultivate them and bring them to the fruition. And then they get picked off by the politicians. Well, they nourished all these crank ideas that became supply-side economics and other notions that the Reagan administration adopted as policy. They got Goldwater by what they call fusion, where Buckley used the glue of anti-communism to bring together various strands of the conservative, on the conservative map, the libertarians, the old-fashioned traditionalists, and some of the new isolationists, and some of the more jingoistic right-wingers. And that had a profound influence on national politics. Ultimately, I went and I got interested in the philosopher Jürgen Habermas, and I went to see him and asked him the question you asked me. I said, what is the role of the Journal of Opinion in this age of conglomerated, homogenated, sensationalized, Murdochized, Oprahficated journalism? And he said, that's obvious. It wasn't obvious to me. And in effect, he said, it is to set the standard for reasoned argumentation. And that's a pretty noble aspiration and a marvelous role for these things that are regarded as relics of the 18th century by many people.
Mm-hmm. And a good example of some of these elements, I believe your journal was the one that published E.P. Thompson's yes. essay on the issues raised by the nuclear buildup
yes.
in Europe.
Protest and Survive.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
And that would be an example of putting ideas on the agenda
yes.
in a way that doesn't necessarily result in victory, but it changes the intellectual approach to a set of problems.
Yes, yeah, someone once said it was publisher named J.W. Gitt from York, Pennsylvania, who said in the middle of the 1940s election, when they were arguing about whether the nation should support the Progressive Party, Henry Wallace for president, or Harry Truman, and the nation didn't support anybody, but Gitt said, the nation is a magazine for the permanent minority. Mm-hmm. And at first I thought about that, and I said to myself, well, that's not so great. Who wants to be permanently in the minority? But then the more I thought about it, I said to myself, hey, just a minute. It was founded by abolitionists who were in the minority when they began the abolitionist movement. It, over the years, has, on a whole range of issues, including the nuclear issue that you mentioned, has brought the danger of nuclear living in a nuclear age to national attention. It fought for civil rights laws, which are now accepted as law of the land. It was in favor of Roe versus Wade, which the latest Supreme Court nominee says is encoded as law of the land. So if being in the permanent minority means being that you are permanently ahead of your time, that's a pretty good place. That's a pretty good place to be. So I don't resent that, but that's one of the roles that it plays, yes.
And so does that tell us what the link is between radical insight and political activism? In other words, it may help churn political activity, but let's not count on it, that change that's being proposed, happening right away.
Well, people who call for immediate action wouldn't put it that way, and I wouldn't quite put it that way. One of our roles is to be a forum for the debate between the radicals and the liberals. And people tend to think of the Journal of Opinion as, and there's a cliche about it, it preaches to the converted or it preaches to the choir. My view about that is, as I say, if we preach to the choir, anyone who reads our letters page will see we have the least harmonious choir in the history of journalism. It's the dialogue, it's the conversation, both inside and with the culture, that distinguishes it. And it's the content of the dialogue that distinguishes it from the mainstream press. So, for example, we have debates in our pages that just don't come up in the mainstream press, or don't usually come up. They cover the differences between the Democrats and the Republicans. We may cover the difference between the Democrats and the socialists, or we may cover the differences between and give expression, voice to, the differences between the radical feminists who believe that pornography should be banned, and the civil libertarians who believe that nothing should be banned. We had a review by Colin Romano of a book by a feminist who believed that pornography was rape, and he began his review with the following outrageous sentence: suppose I raped Catherine McKinnon, who wrote the book. Well, outrageous statement, but he meant to be outrageous. It provoked a lot of things. He said, yeah, you should be outraged, but pornography isn't rape. And you shouldn't use that formulation lightly. That was his argument. And she said, well, and she had a response. And that's part of our function. Same way we have debates in our magazine between the pacifists and the human rights interventionists. That's a very different debate than the one going on about should we be in Iraq or not, which we also play a major, significant role in.
One of the agendas that you brought to the nation that emerges in your account of your work there is bringing an even greater international focus to issues and working with comparable journals abroad, even exchanging journalists with journals like The Statesman in Great Britain. What led you to that, and do you think you accomplished something there that was good not only for the nation but for the national agenda?
Yes. Well, first of all, when I came to the nation, I thought it was important we have at least one piece that covered international affairs, foreign policy per issue. Within a few years, we only run five major pieces. Four of them dealt with international. I mean, there was the globalization of the culture and of the economy and of the media. And so how do you cover that? Now before the internet, there were, you know, in almost every major country in the Western community, there was an equivalent. It was not the same and not quite, but in England it was the New Statesman, in Italy it was Il Manifesto, in Sweden it was Svedvenskaya Dagbladet, in Denmark it was Information. And so we decided to call a conference of all these journals and to discuss ways we might cooperate in investigative journalism on international problems, because how do you investigate the transnational, multinational corporation? It's very expensive, and they're insulated, and they know how to keep journalists at bay. Well, our thought was that we could collaborate on stories with journalists from these different places, and that we could also, our fees were modest, but if you pooled them all, we had a shot at paying a journalist a decent wage, and that we might get some foundations to put up travel money. And so we had a series of international conferences, and the way we organized them was we'd find a partner, and we'd raise the money to bring people over, and they would raise the money to house them and feed them and have a place where they could meet while they were there. And this, we had one in Amsterdam, one in London, outside of London, one in the former Soviet Union, where it met at the Moscow State University Journalism School. And these were very productive sessions. We tried to set up a network that would survive in between conferences, and the internet came along and sort of outdated it a little bit, but and we all got occupied with other things. But the impulse for international exchange of information, collaboration, and also we thought we could publicize stories. So instead of saying today The Nation magazine said this, you could say today The Nation magazine in New York, The New Statesman in London, Svedvenskaya, all claimed, and you might highlight in each story a different thing that dealt with what was happening in their country, but you'd have the universal story be the same. Connections where intelligence agencies were collaborating, or some corporate pollution story. And these were, it was a very exciting project. Sorry, it's still not ongoing, but we made acquaintance and have relationships that endure to this day, and run articles by people who showed up at these conferences or people who were put in touch with us through them.
Writer, editor, and then publisher.
Yes.
And a theme that emerges in your book, a very important theme, is this tension between the business side of a publication and the editing side. And so this is about a dialogue in a way that every magazine experienced, but it's a dialogue within yourself, because you've been in the editor's seat and in the publisher's seat, and you were the business guy in the beginning at Monocle. So what is the best relationship between these two roles in a journal like The Nation?
Well, that's a great question, and I don't know the answer. I do explore it. At the New Statesman, the editor, Bruce Page, once wrote that the reason a worker-owned cooperative enterprise, which one would think, if you're a journal on the left, you should have, wouldn't work there. Is it socialist? He said, suppose you have to decide you've got a limited budget, And should this budget go to health care for the employees or some highly speculative investigative story that you don't know if it's going to work out, and you put it to a vote of families who've got babies to take care of and all that, it doesn't work. And then, you know, should it be owned by overseas corporations? Well, that doesn't work. That imposes other obligations. So there isn't, and should it be nonprofit in this country? Well, if you're a nonprofit, you can't endorse candidates for office. You can't devote more than a certain percentage of what you do to trying to influence legislation. That's not good for a weekly magazine of the nation's sort. Mother Jones had its tax status challenged. It's organized as a nonprofit under Reagan. And had the administration succeeded, they didn't. But it cost Mother Jones years of resistance and hundreds of thousands of dollars defending themselves. But had they succeeded, the government would go after you not just for all of the monies that you didn't pay in mailings because you got lower mailing rates over the years, but interest and penalty payments, and it can come to millions of dollars, and they'll put you out of business. Mm-hmm. So in our case, anyway, we didn't want to be nonprofit. One formula that seems to have worked is where you have the owner and the editor be the same person. Well, that's nice if you happen to be the owner and editor, or if you happen to agree with the politics of the owner and editor, but it eliminates one source of tension. But it limits the possibility of putting out these magazines to very rich people. And another device that has been tried with some success someplace and not at others, is to have some kind of system of trustees. I was a trustee, in effect. They called it an e-shareholder, but along with three or four other people at the New Statesman, and our job was, if there was going to be any fundamental change, and like they were going to fire the editor, or they were going to start it out as a socialist magazine, they were going to abandon that and become a... The e-shareholders had to agree. Well, that worked fine for X years, and then... They got a proprietor who said, you guys have authority without responsibility. Resign. I don't want to deal with you. And we thought we were trustees, and we had the responsibility of staying in power. And there was a lot of tension between him and the trustees, and eventually he said, I'm going to put the magazine in bankruptcy unless you resign. And there was someone else who was online who said, if he puts it in bankruptcy, I'll buy it and reappoint you. So we gave him permission to put it in bankruptcy, which he did. The new guy did buy it, and then he didn't reappoint us. So there isn't a perfect system. The way the nation is set up to achieve the independence, which is the critical variable, it seems to me, is like a Broadway show. And you have one general partner. I happen to be it now, and I've got a designated successor, I hope. And all of the investors have no say in the day-to-day operation. But The Nation is America's oldest weekly magazine, and when people for years would ask me, what's the secret of The Nation's success, I would say, this is off the record, don't tell anyone, it's that we've lost money for 140 years, right. Because we're more a cause than a business. Mm-hmm. Now, the last couple of years, we made a little money, so I'm very worried that I've destroyed this tradition of 140 years, and because what happens is if you start making a lot of money, then people invest in you with the expectation of making more money, and they want a proper return on their investment. And then the way you get a proper return on your investment, classically, is you moderate the tone in order to attract more advertisement. And if you become more and more successful, you become a candidate for takeover, and then you're taken over by one of these transnational conglomerates, and that's it, it's the end. Or you become more and more like everybody else, and there's less and less reason for you to be in business. And so you sort of fade into the woodwork. So it's a very delicate balance that you got to achieve between the business side and the editorial side.
The media has merged, you know, under a few powerful entities like Murdoch and his corporation, trends that was anticipated, yes, in your journal by, among other reports, by Ben Begdigian, and who's here at Berkeley, and his book. I would like your insight as to what extent has the conventional wisdom that you are trying to inform and influence in different kind of ways. In what way has it dumbed down the conventional wisdom now and become more entrenched? Does that make If that is happening, does that make the work of a journal like The Nation easier, or does it make it harder?
To the extent that the major media, the mainstream media, the conventional media, recycle the same old ideas and become homogenized by virtue of buying up independent voices and then having them become part of a chain which has all run the same news stories and the same editorial page, which not all chains do, by the way, but to the extent that they do, to the extent that they share the same assumptions, they have deeded a monopoly in the business of questioning assumptions and creating new perspectives to journals like ours. And that's a great irony. I mean, I consider that we are presented with that kind of monopoly. We have a literal monopoly on weekly progressive magazine journalism. New Republic has gone off in a way that where they don't want to be called left, certainly, and even liberal they have questions about. The National Review is a biweekly. It's not even a weekly, but it's not a progressive magazine. But Commonweal Catholic magazine is now biweekly. American Prospect is bimonthly. So these magazines as a class have been given something of a monopoly on serious journalistic political discourse to the extent that there's been a dumbing down of the mainstream media. Now, you have op-ed pages, you have bloggers, you have all kinds of ways that you can, there is an opinion industry out there, and it's pretty big, but serious analytical moral and political argument with the space to document your case is a rarity in the culture, and we are the exponents and the possessors of it.
And you're doing well. You have a larger subscription base. Well, relatively
yes.
Well.
Yes.
But you have a larger subscription
Look,
when
base. When I came to The Nation in 1978 with young Hamilton Fish as the publisher, I was the editor. We were told that we had 25,000 subscribers. When we got there, we found out we did, but 5,000 had expired and their subscriptions had run out. I had a friend, Jack Newfield, advocacy journalist, alas, died last year. He said to me, "How many subscribers do you have?" So I said, "Jack, we have 20,000, but 8,000 are libraries." He said, "Oh, 8,000 libraries and 12,000 nursing homes," because his image was that, you know, this is a... And Ham had a joke. He said, our publisher, "When our subscribers expire, they really expire." So we went out of our way to build younger things. Okay. Last year, we were now audited, and our audit showed that we had 184,000 some few hundred paying readers of The Nation. And 28,000 of them, of our subscribers, came to us over our free website, and they became paying subscribers to the hard copy magazine. So that both changes the composition of the magazine, it changes the cost of acquiring new readers, because it doesn't cost you to get them on the website. There are some costs associated with it, the cost of the people who put things up, the cost of the material on it, but the classic way of recruiting new subscribers in the old days was, and still is, direct mail. You know, and direct mail is increasingly expensive as postal rates go up. And yes, people, for years we had a very bad joke. If it's bad for the country, it's good for the nation, was our joke. So people say, "How are you doing?" I say, "Better than ever. We're in a lot of trouble." You know.
One final question requiring a brief answer. If students were to watch this interview, how would you advise them to prepare for a career in journalism or journalism in law, knowing what you know based on your life, but also your insights about where the Journal of Opinion is going in the future and what the needs will be for such a publication in the future?
Well, first of all, I would say read. Go to the period, if you're in school, go to the periodicals room of your local library, whether you're in school or not, and browse. And spend all your free time there. I mean, go to the ball game and don't give up your social life. But in between class and whenever you can, do it. You'll find, you'll learn a lot, and you'll find places that you will aspire to write for if that's within you. Secondly, I think it pays to attempt to freelance as a young person. You have the luxury of studying things in depth. You may not have the broadness that comes with the years, but you do have the energy and the time to and find things that are related to what you're studying that have contemporary relevance and learn the different formats by reading. And send to the places that seem that you feel enter at the point of least resistance, and whether you're freelancing for your local community newspaper or something much fancier that has a national reputation, it's a way the classic way to break in. Now it's always better to do that if you know someone who knows someone, so that you're not sending a letter to a title, you're sending it to a person. And classically, which if you don't know someone who knows someone, and usually if you're in a journalism school or any other kind of school, you'll find one way or another you know someone who knows someone who knows someone. But if you can't do it that way, I'd pick a name off the masthead and send it there. Whether you send it by email or snail mail, up to you. These cultural traditions are changing. They're different at different places. My friend Ed Doctorow, the novelist, always says, enter at the point of least resistance if it's a place you want to go. As far as journalism school itself goes, I think a school like Berkeley, a school like Columbia, you can't go wrong by going there, but it's not for everybody, and you can be a journalist without going there. So I think it's... but it makes your job easier, and it makes getting a job easier.
On that note, Victor, I want to thank you very much for being here today. I want to show your book, A Matter of Opinion, a quite interesting account of the struggles of a journal of opinion and the career and story, really, of an editor-publisher who's played a remarkable role in shaping the nation over the last 20-plus years. Thanks again. Thank you for coming. And thank you very much for joining us for a conversation with history.